Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 163, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
Now, what a show we've got for you this week. Not only are we going to be talking about, because we love covering new games for old systems, and a friend of ours is actually making a brilliant game for the Commodore 64.
There's been a lot of C64 titles coming out recently, hasn't there?
It's crazy. It's like, you know, probably more titles coming out for these retro platforms now than any time since they were like mainstream computers and chopped.
It's awesome.
It's nuts, isn't it? And also, maybe you'll get to decide what games are going to be on the Mega Drive Mini. It looks like that might be happening. We'll talk more about that in the next few minutes on the Retro Hour podcast. And this week, we're going to be joined by an amazing guest. Now, it seems like we're going all over the world at the moment. This week, our guest is actually British. He's from London, but we're crossing to the Sunshine State of California.
Yeah, we're talking to Christian Simpson of Periphractic Retro Recipes. If you've seen that, it's a really good channel. He does some pretty awesome stuff. He's been doing these Lego cases, so he rebuilt a full C64 with working keys and everything out of Lego.
Yeah, and he did like an apple pie, I remember, putting like a Raspberry Pi in an Apple II case. Some really kind of off-the-wall stuff like that. And Christian himself, I mean, he's a really interesting guy. Probably the only guest we've spoken to has actually been in a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so we'll find out more about that. Really interesting, this week's guest, Christian Simpson. It's going to be very nostalgic. He's coming up on the Retro Hour podcast in around 15 minutes from now. Now, before we get into this week's show, let's give a big thank you to the people who make the Retro Hour podcast possible. The fact that me and Ravi can come in here every week and tell you the retro gaming news and bring you guests like Christian Simpson. And that is people who make a donation into the running of the show. Now, we say this all the time, it's optional, it's a tip jar, isn't it?
It's a tip jar, yeah, just to help the show out. You know, we have website costs and all of this, and you guys kind of keep us running, thank you.
Yeah, so we really appreciate it. And of course, for making a donation of any amount at all, every pound, every cent, every dollar, it all goes back into the pot and keeps the show going week in, week out. And you will get a mention in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame on a future episode. And this week, let's show some love to Patrick McGinty,
Mark Sorrance,
Darren Coles,
and Mark Hughes,
who all made donations into the running of the show. And if you'd like to do the same, honestly, it takes like 5 seconds. All you've got to do is nip onto our website, click on the Support Us section at the top bar there at theretrohour.com. And while we're talking about people that make this show possible, amazing that The Economist are back on board with us again this week.
Oh, awesome. Yes, thank you so much.
Now, they were a big supporter of the Retro Hour podcast at the back end of last year. And we're pleased to say, again, we've got an amazing offer for you. Now, The Economist, we've talked about them before on the show. I mean, really, The Economist is a smart guide to the forces impacting our world. Now, you know, when you hear the title The Economist, a lot of people think, oh, is it all about finances and stuff like that? It is, but it covers a lot more as well.
It does, and they're all really intelligently written articles.
One thing you've been looking at, the Netflix of gaming.
Yeah, so for years people have kind of been trying to do game streaming. Now, there's a fantastic article about how there's a kind of battle at the moment to be the Netflix of game streaming. Because, yeah, you know, we've got movie streaming. And it's all about that zero latency. And I think, you know, they need that killer product. Because, you know, when a lot of these games come out online, they always crash.
Yeah.
Because there's too many people on the server or too much demand. So I think they need a wonderful killer product, and one of these companies is going to crack it eventually.
And this article's kind of talking about which ones you should be keeping an eye out for.
Yeah, and which ones haven't worked, and kind of, you know, about the future battle.
The thing about The Economist as well that we love is, I mean, we've talked about this before on the podcast. In this day and age, there's so much kind of false news around and clickbaity headlines. You even left social media for a bit because you were sick of it.
Oh, yeah. I'm not on Facebook anymore. Yeah. I only use Facebook for streaming because there was so much inaccurate stuff being constantly shared.
That's why stuff like The Economist, I think, you know, the time that we live in now, facts are more important than ever. And The Economist will sift through all that noise and help you make up your mind on things that are really important. I mean, they've been going over 170 years, so you know you can trust them. Now, if you want to get a free copy of The Economist, we've got an offer for you. If you want to get your own copy in the post, proper print copy of the magazine, I love reading magazines anyway. Now, all you have to do, we've got this little offer on, text the word retro and send it to 78070. Not only will you get your free print copy of The Economist, but also you'll be helping out the podcast as well. So all you've got to do is text RETRO to 78070 with The Economist, the smart guide to the forces changing your world. Right then, let's talk about this interesting little product that you found for the PlayStation Classic. A lot of people have written off the PlayStation Classic. You know, you've seen it in, like, bargain bins in supermarkets and stuff now.
Yeah, because the PlayStation Classic, it came out at around, well, $100 was the price, and it came with 20 preloaded games. So a lot of people were kind of like, oh, this machine... It wasn't a very good effort by Sony, they say. But as we know with these devices, they can always have additional mods and stuff that really make these machines fly. Now, they've dropped the price universally of the PlayStation Classic, so it's around $40.
I've seen it for about 30 quid in some shops.
Wow, yeah. So that's awesome. And they're basically saying there's this way that officially last year... we learned about them being able to sideload stuff. And they were sideloading stuff with this really amazing modding tool. And it's got a strange name, BleemSync. So I don't know if you remember Bleem.
Yeah, I remember BleemCast on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, yeah. BleemCast was a way
PlayStation
of playing PlayStation games on it. So BleemSync is obviously a way of playing all the other systems on your PlayStation Classic. So the things that BleemSync's offer... It's basically got full support of RetroArch and integration, so you can load up your different systems, your different cores as well, play them. It's also got a faster filer system. It has optimizations for the PlayStation Mini as well, and you can use any Bluetooth controller on it, so you can get like your Xbox One controller or even your modern PlayStation 4 ones.
That's
cool. Have them connected up to your little PlayStation Mini.
So really it turns this device, really, I mean, you know, we all watched those YouTube videos last year. I've played with a PlayStation Classic. I haven't got one, because, you know, I've got an original PlayStation anyway. I've got about 4 of them, actually, I think. But I think now it's kind of turning this product into something that is usable and people can actually enjoy.
Yeah, definitely, because they're saying here they've even got add-on packs. So they have a cheat add-on pack.
Right.
So you can obviously have loads of cheats and an overlay pack, so you can start customising all the menus and overlays and kind of basically ignoring that Sony setup that they had on there initially.
You just picture it now, like Asda and Game and stuff, suddenly they're going to start selling like hotcakes. And we should have kept the price high, what's going on here? So if you want to mod it, I mean, I've read it's actually quite a simple system to mod as well. It's not too complicated. So if you want to find out more about that, I love the fact they've called it Bleem as well. I don't know if there's any relation or whether it's kind of just
No, it seems to be by these guys called Mod My Classics.
Okay. Yeah, very cool. So I'll put a link to that in this week's show notes. And the rest of the stories that we talk about, you can find them every week at theretrohour.com. Now, we did mention about an amazing new game that's coming out for one of our favourite platforms, for the Commodore 64, and this is by a good friend of ours, Steve from Wavem Studios. Now, this is a new shoot-em-up, actually, called Cosmic Force. Now, Steve is actually away at the moment in Tenerife, but he's been kind enough to take a bit of time out of his holiday and come on the podcast. So, welcome to the show, Steve.
All right, there. How are you doing? Like, Dan?
Yeah,
Robbie.
Very good. You're in Tenerife at the moment while we're in rainy Nottingham.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit of a working holiday, but yeah, that's all right. The power of the internet, eh?
Exactly. Well, I know things have been pretty busy for you recently. You did, a lot of people know you from the Commodore Story documentary, and that was obviously a real love letter to Commodore, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was an idea that came together, and really, yeah, it was a work of passion, and like going out there and meeting all these famous people, you know, all the legends of Commodore was awesome. And really glad that we did it, and like now we're moving on to something just a little bit different than a documentary.
Yeah, so you're going to be writing a game for the original Commodore 64 called Cosmic Force. So tell us a bit about the game and kind of what games it's been inspired by.
So ever since I got my first Commodore computer, I've always been into shoot 'em up games, and in fact, part of it comes from my uncle owning an arcade in a little place called Great Arwood in Lancashire, and it was called the Lucky Nudges. And I used to go in, and he'd give me like a pile of 10 pences, and I'd be there playing on Defender and Galaxian, and so that's where some of the inspirations started to come from. And I wanted to like recreate that feel of being in the arcade and a good old shoot 'em up. So the inspiration, like I say, is Galaxian and Defender, but also one of my all-time favourite games was the vector-driven Star Wars game, and I want to try and put a bit of that into there as well, which it's all going to be a challenge, but we've done some prototyping and we know it's possible, so let's do it.
Well, you've also got some awesome people on board with this project, haven't you?
Yeah. Whilst we were filming the Commodore story, we met a guy called Derek Morris, and at the time he was talking about writing a book called Retro Game Development. And he said to me, have you got any words of advice? I said, yeah, just do it. And lo and behold, he did do it, and it's become a pretty good book. And I know he's busy now working on Volume 2, which is going to go into a bit more detail. So Derek is part of the technical advice and programming advice there. And also we've got a guy that runs a website called 64bytes.com, Michael Tazinski. And he is quite a young guy, actually, for the Commodore 64 front, but he's really gone into a deep dive into the, you know, programming to the metal and getting the best out of the Commodore 64 and
bang those chips.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and also we want to take a lot of inspiration from the demo scene as well, you know. Mm. So you know, for what we want to do with the game, it is going to take a lot of effort and a lot of development in there. So it's really great to have these experts on board that can put some extra inspiration and just you know, under the bonnet know-how.
Well, talking of, you know, legends that you've got involved, and the music, from what I've heard so far, you know, got Jason Page and the legendary Rob Hubbard is going to be doing some music for the game.
Yeah, so this track does already exist, and it was part of Project Hubbard. It's a track called Radio Ace. So I got in touch with Chris Abbott and said, you know, that this track, that we really love it, and it would be great if we could put it into Cosmic Force. The feedback that I got is that this track has never actually been used in a game before, and so it's really good that we're able to do this. Yeah, and of course Jason Page, he's worked closely with Rob Hubbard. I'll tell you what, he is absolutely awesome. You know, the track that he has made for Cosmic Force, which is named Cosmic Force, it's got all the tweaks and the twiddles that you would hear from a Rob Hubbard track. But of course, it's a Jason Page track, and it, you know, you just got to listen to it. It's fantastic.
Well, if we can play a bit of it in the show, that'd be awesome. If that's all right with you, I might go into our interview today with it.
Yeah. I think Jason would absolutely love that.
Awesome.
Well, also, it's getting released on 5.25 floppy disk and cassette as well, USB cassette, which we've seen the Hoosom releases come out on these nice little USB cassettes. And you're doing a documentary about it as well.
Well, you know, to keep in style with Wave M Studios, you know, we did the Commodore story, and of course we got to film every step of the way with Cosmic Force, and yes, we're creating a documentary called The Creation of an 8-Bit Shoot 'Em Up. The documentary is not going to tell you exactly, you know, which buttons to press to program the game, but what it will show you is the collaboration and the sort of things you need to do to put a game together. So it's about the music, it's about the concept, it's about the gameplay. And, yeah, we're putting it out on a few different formats, and we're very excited to put the game out on original floppy. Yeah. You know, so like I say in the campaign, you know, you get your floppy, you stick it in, and then and then you start firing away, you know, so that's what it's about.
Steve's been under sangria, hasn't he, in Tenerife, I can tell.
Yeah, I think I've got jet lag.
But I know you mean, there is something though about putting like a 5.25-inch disc into a 1541 drive, here in the head spin up and everything. It's very nostalgic.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we've had a few questions from people, why can't it be on cassette? And, of course, we are going to put it onto USB cassette. Mm. But the game isn't designed for traditional cassette because it's going to have too many levels, like too many stages, too much data to load in, you know. So you could put it on cassette, but it's going to be quite laborious, like waiting for the cassette, you know. So the idea of putting it on a USB cassette is to keep that nostalgia, but use some of the modern tools, you know. Mm. So the disk drive emulator, also. We're making sure that it'll work with the C65 Mini and also Gideon's new machine that he's working on, the Ultimate 64. Yeah. It's going to work on all them platforms, you know, including Raspberry Pi. Basically, anything that runs a VICE emulator, then it'll work with that as well. So,
Well, I think, you know, obviously all our audience, I'm sure, would be big fans of this game. You know, anyone who loves stuff like Galaxian and Galaga and Defender, all those classics. I mean, it looks the usual quality that we expect from Wavum Studios, Steve. So we can't wait to see the game. It's running on Kickstarter at the moment. And of course, we'll put a link in our show notes at theretrohour.com if people want to find out more.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for having me on the show. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Now, before we get into our chat with Christian Simpson, going all over today, Tenerife, straight to California. Well, we sit here in a rainy Nottingham city centre at the moment. But we need to talk about the Mega Drive Mini. Now, it's something we did mention on the show last year. There's been lots of rumours, and it kind of makes sense, you know. Sony have done it. Nintendo have done it twice now. Everyone wants Sega to do their own mini Mega Drive console.
Well, they'd done one before with At Games. Yep. That was not very good. It was licensed by them, and the kind of sound was really bad on it.
Yeah.
There's been a few versions coming, and they were going to do another one this year, but then they actually recalled it. Well, last year, yeah. 2018, they actually recalled it and said, we need to spend a bit more time on this to make it really good.
Now it seems Sega listened to the community.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I've seen a lot of articles, actually, recently, saying... by journalists that put them out saying, oh, no one's going to buy these mini consoles. They're not going to be a success at all. And now I've seen all these articles going, I was wrong, I admit it.
Was that before like the NES and all that came
out?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it does make sense that Sega are going to do a Mega Drive Mini. But the thing about it is, that I think the good point about this is it looks like they're going to be taking it in-house and doing it themselves.
Awesome. Because stuff like, you know, Sonic Mania, that was... beautiful.
Well, you know, we've got friends who work with Sega at the moment, Kim Justice and Dan from Slopes Game Room. You know, they're working at the moment with Sega. So it seems like, you know, Sega are now paying attention to the retro community.
Yeah.
Because that's where, you know, their hardcore fans are there, aren't they?
Definitely. They need to use those assets and use their history as well.
So at the moment, there is, this is quite interesting and very telling that, you know, the Mega Drive Mini is on the way. There's a poll that they're running on Twitter. This is Sega of Japan, asking people what games they would like to see if they were to do a mini console. And they've kind of been doing these, you know, you can do polls on Twitter, can't you?
Yeah.
There are a couple of these. Interestingly, I mean, it's a lot of the big games you'd expect. They've put, you know, the first poll is Sonic the Hedgehog 1 against Sonic 2. Which one would you prefer? Puyo Puyo, which was one of my favourite games, actually, on the Mega Drive. Shining Force or Shining Force 2. So this, you know, kind of seems to be those games you'd expect to see on there anyway. One thing I was a bit confused about is, why don't they just put them all on?
True. I don't know. Maybe they've got licensing agreements with certain things, but all these franchises, I guess they own anyway.
Yeah,
they?
I mean,
like Puyo Puyo and Sonic. And
yeah, the one that you don't normally see, I think, is Sonic 3, which, because, you know, Michael Jackson did some of the music on
it. Yeah, I saw an excellent video the other day by Digitizer, Mr. Biffo, who did a full kind of look at the whole Michael Jackson music thing, and it was really interesting. And he actually says it's a lot of the reason why it's not used. It's because of the legal issues behind it.
Yeah, I think the Jackson family estate still own the copyright on that music, so it's probably going to mean that, you know, that's going to be left off. But then again, I mean, we've just been talking about it. Chances are it'll be out a week and it'll get hacked.
And I guess if this is Sega Japan,
yeah,
they're then talking to the Japanese audience because this is all in Japanese. So I can't understand it. I hope that Sega America doesn't do a rival poll and then suddenly we get the two systems.
With completely different games on them. That's a good shout, though, because, I mean, people will probably buy them twice then, wouldn't they?
Maybe they'll have an American version and a Japanese version like they had with the C64 Mini.
That could be, yeah, or even the original Mega Drive. I'd love to see it, because actually they did that with the Nintendos, didn't they? They released different variants.
The Famicom one. So,
I mean, I always love the look of the Mega Drive from Japan, you know, the big 16-bit font and the purple on the bottom. That looked really cool. But even, you know, everyone's got their own wish list of games they'd love to see on there. As we were talking about a minute ago, this will be out 2 days and it'll be hacked anyway, so you probably better put anything you want on after a couple of days. So if you want to find out more about that, maybe even vote in the poll, you know, might help them out, decide what they're going to put on there. We'll put all that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Right, there'll be more news on next Friday's show. Right now, let's cross over to California. This is such a nostalgic chat. Really enjoyed this week's interview with Christian Simpson from Perifractic's Retro Recipes. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. We are loving his YouTube channel at the moment. Welcome to the show, Christian Simpson from, now let me make sure I say this right, Perifractics Retro Recipes.
Perifractics Retro Recipes. Yes, welcome and hello, and great to be here, guys. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on. Now, I mean, for people that might not be familiar with your channel yet, I mean, kind of give us a bit of background on what your channel's about, what kind of stuff you cover.
So Retro Recipes, it's not cooking. Some people do get confused, but basically I just cover everything retro, from my favourites, the Commodore 64, Commodore Amiga, to Apple IIe, Atari's, ZX Spectrum Next, even the Amstrad PCW8256. So I tend to do a lot of unique kind of projects. So whether it's turning a Raspberry Pi into what we call the Apple Pi, there's a collab I did with Mindflare Retro and Jan Bieter over in Germany and the 8-Bit Guy, or most recently building a full-size working Lego Commodore 64.
So where did the name Perifractic come from?
That's a good question, and one I get asked quite a lot. So Perifractic, basically, when I was back in school, there was a very eccentric kid, and he was a couple of years ahead of his age. And he said to me, took me aside one day, just randomly, and he said, okay, Christian, your name is Chrysostomatico Perifractic Habitanimaliculicatescia Boblus, and I want you to remember that for the rest of your life. And he made me learn it. And when I was figuring out a YouTube handle, I'd always had Perifractic in my mind. So it just kind of stuck around. And yeah, that's how it became Perifractics Retro Recipes.
That's amazing. It stuck with you all this time.
Yeah. Well, when someone makes you learn something when you're 12 years old and repeat it, I think about 20 times, it sticks with you. So I guess thanks to him.
Well, your day job's really interesting as well. I mean, I was looking through some of your kind of biogs online, and you're a screenwriter and actor as well.
Yeah, I've done a bit. I've been really lucky. So I'm actually in California now. So I've been here about nine or 10 years now in Los Angeles. But back when I was in London, we heard about these new Star Wars films they were going to be making, ended up being the prequels. You know, say what you will about them, but I was excited, you know, for the prospect of being in those. And I'd studied drama in college and stuff. Weirdly, shared a classroom with Kate Beckinsale for about 7 years, like literally sitting next to me.
Oh, cool.
And so I just got onto my agent and I said, they are apparently they're going to make these new Star Wars movies in 1997. Can you please just get me an audition? And somehow I got an audition. Somehow I showed up and did the, you know, they took photos, filmed you for the director, which I assume was George Lucas was going to be reviewing these. And then I waited by the phone for a couple of months, not hours, I wish. And about 2 months later, I got the call from my agent. She said, oh, hey, Christian, are you available in August for a couple of months? And I said, yeah, what's it for? She said, oh, they want you for Star Wars. And you can imagine any geek's dream, and I am a geek. Yeah, I managed to hold onto the phone handset and just see the conversation through to the end. So they cast me as a Naboo fighter pilot called Lieutenant Gavin Sykes. And if you ever played Battle for Naboo, so now we're getting back to the retro stuff, it was on the Nintendo 64 and every other platform. Mm. So you play through that game as Gavin Sykes. So that's me. And it's a weird little tie-in, yeah. So I carried on acting from there and had a lot of fun with it. And now out here, I do a lot of voice acting and narration. I guess most recently, if you turn on the audio description on Avengers Infinity War, if you have that on Blu-ray or streaming, I'll narrate the whole movie for you, which is kind of fun.
So you totally get to geek out in your job, really?
Totally. I get to geek out and then stay completely silent about it for several months until a film comes out, which is not exciting and not enjoyable at all. Don't even tell Mrs. Perifractic. So it's a blessing and a curse, but yeah, very lucky.
Well, let's get really geeky then, Christian. Let's get into stuff that we cover on YouTube and this show. I mean, where did your journey with computers begin?
So that began when I was 8 years old. My dad brought home an Apple IIe, and I just fell in love. You know, as you do if you're a kid that just clicks with, and I would just remember sitting there for hours, you know, typing away, programming stuff in BASIC. And my first memory is playing the introduction to Apple IIe disc, which had a couple of little games on it, and it would teach you, you know, like what the enter key does and all these things. And from there, it was just a love affair with that technology. I've persuaded my mum to buy me an Atari 400 because I thought that the Parker Brothers Empire Strikes Back cartridge, which said on it for Atari video game systems, would work on the Atari 400 because that's a video game system, right? So she bought me this Atari 400, and then, of course, that game does not work on it. So I played like Asteroids for about 2 years on repeat. And then just evolved into the usual ones, Commodore 64. I went from Amiga and flip-flopped to Atari ST and back again, and just continued with that. And it's funny, isn't it? It's so strongly tied into nostalgia and childhood. And I really try to play into that because that's what it's about for me as a hobby. So on the YouTube channel, I'm always revisiting some of the strongest memories that I think come from these machines, because I feel ultimately that's what the love is. It is for the machines, but it's also for the memories. So, yeah.
So was your dad into computers too then, if he kind of turned up with an Apple too?
So for him, it was basically the spreadsheet feature. So I definitely wouldn't say that either of my parents were into computers, but he was a chartered quantity surveyor, so getting spreadsheets and stuff was crucial. So he certainly learned how to use those, whereas I was more like programming and playing the games. And I think it's fair to say I probably stole the computers, that all the ones that he ever bought, from him time-wise. I was probably on them a good five times longer than they were, yeah.
Well, which games kind of bring back the fondest childhood memories for you then?
I think probably the most nostalgic is Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Not only a great game, but it's about how these things are burned into your memories. It's different for all of us. For me, I remember that very distinctive. If you remember, it had a clamshell black plastic packaging. It didn't have like a regular cassette.
Yeah, it was bigger, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit bigger. Mm. And, well, by the way, if I do sound croaky or stuffy, I do apologize. I'm down with this cold/flu thing that seems to be going around the YouTubers.
The retro-lurgy.
I don't quite know how that works. I watched a video with LGR and he was down with the flu and then I came down with it. So some sort of virus, computer virus.
It's a new algorithm, that's what it is.
Need to install Norton on us all, I think.
I've installed Virus Z on the Amiga, so I've inserted that floppy and we'll see how it goes. So under the Christmas tree this Christmas, I was, not this Christmas, but back when I was, I guess, 11, I could feel the Ghostbusters shape of that clamshell in the wrapping. You know, the old Luke Skywalker joke, Darth Vader, I felt his presence. And there I was feeling my presence. And I remember my friend came around and he said in front of my dad, oh, that's Ghostbusters. And I was so mad at him for like ruining the surprise and spoiling it for my dad, even though I knew exactly what it was, Ghostbusters. So then Christmas Day, unwrapped it. It was Ghostbusters. Yay. Ghostbusters. Loaded it up. And I remember you get the loading flashes and stripes on the screen, and it would get to the very end of the tape, do the final flashes before it would load, and then just go blank. And pretty much all of Christmas Day, I was just loading this, trying to get this game to load, doing the azimuth alignment in the screw hole of the C2N Commodore cassette player, trying both sides of the tape, and turned out it was faulty, and Christmas was ruined. But we went back day after Boxing Day, got a replacement, and then it worked.
I had a similar experience, yeah. Actually. I remember do you remember the game Z-Wolf on the Amiga? Mm. I really wanted that for ages. My mum got me a copy of that, and then I put the disc in, and like a blue screen came up. It wouldn't load, so I had to wait till the shops reopened.
No. But did you then enjoy the game more as a result when you finally got it working?
Oh, yeah, I think so, yeah. The anticipation of it, you know, wanting to play it, I guess.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. What about you, Ravi?
I just got crack games. if it was ruined, right. I'd just go to the dodgy shop and the guy would get Dopus open, chuck the disc in the bin, and then just write a new one.
So do we have you to thank for the downfall of the entire industry? Or
maybe my local shop, yeah.
That's why we do this, to make up for killing the 8-bit and 16-bit industry.
We're trying to bring it back slowly, like one channel at a time. I never had one of those dodgy shops, though. That's weird.
I think Nottingham seemed to be a bit of a hub for it, the East Midlands.
Ah, okay, fair enough.
I was wondering, because you had so many different systems as a kid, like, what magazines would you be reading? Would you have one that you were totally into, or would you kind of pick and mix?
Yeah, the main one was Playboy. oh, I see what you mean, sorry, my mistake. it was definitely Zap 64 all the way. We never had like an Atari or an Apple mag. And I think, yeah, what was after Zap 64? There was probably, was it Amiga Format was the next one that I had. And those are the only two I think I subscribed to up until Retro Gamer more recently, which I get delivered here in America every month. Love that. And would you believe someone contacted me a couple of days ago from Zap 64 and they're going to do an interview for the Lego Commodore 64. So I'm finally get my childhood dream to actually be in Zap 64. I wrote them so many letters as a kid and a teenager, never got published. So that I'm very excited for that, as you might imagine.
Well, are you more of a computer fan or do you like consoles too?
I like consoles, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we've got a PS4 and a C64 Mini. They're both consoles, right? and I have really fond memories of playing Super Mario World on the SNES. Mm. I would go to the Woolworths, get some pick and mix, and just have marathon sessions of Super Nintendo, Super Mario World. And I've now got a SNES Mini, which probably doesn't count as retro, but I didn't have any more space left on the desk, so it had to be a Mini.
Well, yeah. How big's your actual console and computer collection? And did you have to bring any over from kind of England? And do you have a hit list of any that you really want to get?
That's a great question. Wow. If I can put it in IKEA terms, so my desk is two IKEA desks long. I don't know if that makes sense. You usually see it behind me in the intro when I do episodes on the YouTube. So there's room for three systems on each side. So I've got six major systems on there, which I flip-flop between in various videos. But on the hit list, I've been waiting for the ZX Spectrum Next to arrive, and that's looking gorgeous. I'm so excited to get that. Other than that, what's remaining for me is the BBC Micro Model B, because that's what we, I don't know if you guys had that in school, but that was what I was using back in school. Me and Kate Beckinsale typing 10, print, hello, 20, go to 10, yay.
I'm playing Granny's Garden.
Yeah, oh my gosh, memories.
You guys are too old, I had Acorns.
That was an Acorn, the Archimedes you mean.
The later ones, the Risk.
It was made by Acorn though, wasn't it, the BBC? Yeah, I think the best memories of the BBC is going into Dixon's and just typing in 10 print Dixon's-ish and then
leaving it on all the screens.
10. Yeah, always, but with multicolours and random sound.
Yeah, we used to do that, and we used to set the timers on the all the radio alarm clocks to come on at the same time and turn them up full blast. That was another good gag we used to do.
We'd just take all the mouse balls out.
Yeah.
That was it.
So we can single-handedly say we brought down the retro industry and Dixon's. So
cool. Where to blame.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, I mean, have you always been into these classic machines, or was there a period when you took a break and kind of rediscovered them again?
Definitely took a break, and I think that's how it works. If you do find them again through nostalgia, it necessitates that you took a break and that you start to miss them and you start to sort of long for those memories. And in a way, the simplicity, because the systems were so limited that it really just helped you being inventive and creative. And for me, it was, having computers that could do anything at your beck and call. I touched on this on a recent video. I did a walkthrough of the new Commodore 64 text adventure called Hibernated by Stefan Vogt. And in the intro, I talked a lot about how I feel like the amazing games today, like Red Dead Redemption 2, everything is just served for you. There is no room for imagination or creativity. And as a kid, imagination is everything. So for me, playing those text adventures, the world was in my mind. It wasn't really on the screen. And that's what I started longing for. So I then that's when I went up into the attic and tried to see what was left of any of the computers. I don't know about you guys, but sadly, because you never envisage you're going to feel this way, I had let my computers go as a kid. So I sold we gave the Commodore 64 to a friend's kid who really wanted one. And I think I sold my A500. I don't know about, how about you guys? Did you manage to hang on to stuff? I know, Dan, you did.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Ravi or scales at me when I mentioned this on the show, but I did actually throw away two Amiga 1200s at one stage,
yeah.
Which, yeah, I so regret doing that now.
We've all done it.
My dad did, like, a monitor call where he had all the monitors and he smashed them with a hammer.
These
beautiful CRTs. And he just left a 2000 out in the rain as well, just to kind of rust up. And I tried to recover it, but, it wouldn't work. He's very brutal, my dad. He used to just, like, chuck your old bike into the big skip, and then you'd be like, Dad, where's my bike? And he's like, I got rid of that rubbish.
Wow. Did he at least film the smashing of the CRTs, or no?
No, but I managed to save all the 4,000, so I had still quite a bit of a big collection afterwards, but yeah, it wasn't what it was.
I think you're right, though, because you don't realise that you're going to value this stuff in like 20 years' time, do you? You think it's kind of worthless, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you saved some of them, Ravi. There's no way to know, but now I do tell people, you know, if they're on a forum and they're saying, oh, I'm finally getting rid of my Commodore 64, I just say, don't do it. You will regret it in 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah, you'll end up buying it back on eBay for like twice the price,
Yeah, exactly. But you never know. For me, I have this hope that I'll find it again. And I do occasionally put out something on AmiBay just saying, hey, if you find a set of discs in this specific handwriting, and I put a little picture, and I would always write backup on them with two little squiggly tilde lines either side of backup. It's very distinctive. And I do scour eBay now and then. And one day I'll get all my floppy disks and all the programs I wrote on the Commodore and the Apple IIe. It'd be nice to get those back, yeah.
Well, you're a big fan of music too. And what's your kind of favourite system for music?
Commodore 64. Next question.
I can see why. The SID chip is just marvellous, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I had a lot of fun with the Commodore Music Maker. I turned it into this really cool keyboard. So I'd seen this thing called the Akai. It was the MK2. And they did a special edition where the black keys were red and the white keys were black. It just looked amazing. So I converted a Commodore Music Maker into this red and black keyed thing. And I added a couple of, you know, tuning knobs so you could adjust the pitch and the open and close filters. That actually plugs into the joystick port because you could actually use paddles with some of these modern C64 SID chip synths like, what's it called? Here, I've got it right here, actually. Let me grab it. Oh, yeah, SynthCart. SynthCart 64 is a new cartridge. And it gives you a way to play the SID chip live, and it has all these predefined voices. So I found a way, that's what I wanted to do, is just be able to play live on a real keyboard, adjust the filters. And I put out a couple of music videos of songs that I made that way. And there's just no chip like the SID chip for me. It's just that analog, juicy, fat sound for me. Yeah.
How about you guys? Got a grittiness to it, hasn't it?
Gritty, it's kind of, sounds broken sometimes. It's like it's alive, I feel. Maybe it is.
Well, one thing anyone who's watched your channel, I'm sure, would love to know, a lady called Ashley appears in your video.
Ashley.
It looks like, you know, she works in Walmart. how did she get involved in your videos, and how did she know so much about retro stuff?
I don't know how it came about. So I think my idea was, wouldn't it be funny if you walk into a store where you would never expect them to know anything about retro computers, ask one of the random shopkeepers, you know, shop sales associates, a question like, can you still buy the Plus 4? Do you sell the Plus 4? And then if they answered in extreme detail, like, oh, no, that was discontinued in 1985. Or I did one of a recent cartridge that has this newish kind of Commodore 64 graphic user interface. And I'll say, you know, oh, yeah, do you sell the multi-gang cart? And at first she's always like, multi-gang of carts? Yeah, here's some carts, like shopping trolleys. But then eventually she's like, oh, no, you have to get that from Poland. She always has the answer. So I walked in and just randomly found her, and she was fantastic. She said, yeah, I'll do that. And I do, obviously. I coach them a little bit of what to say, and then we just kind of ad-lib and improv. But she really struck a chord with viewers. And up until a couple of days ago, I'd never met her outside Walmart. So I thought, okay, it's time that I had like a business lunch with her and just talk about some proper ideas. So we actually got together for lunch, and it was a lot of fun. She showed up in a Yoshi t-shirt. And turns out she actually loves playing video games and Nintendo 64 and stuff like that, which was a surprise. I thought she would know nothing, and she does. So What we're going to do, I asked my patrons to put questions to her. So I'm doing an episode called Ask Ashley. And I've got some really great questions lined up for her. I haven't told her what they're going to be. I'm not coaching her this time. So we're going to get some real responses. And then I think what we're going to do is Ashley Reacts. So you know the channel Kids React.
Yeah.
So stick her in front of a Commodore 64, give her a tape and say, okay, load Blockbusters with Bob Holness. And just see how it goes. Just wing it and see.
It's really interesting that you guys kind of interact at Walmart as well, because Walmart is a totally kind of different world to any of the supermarkets in the UK. When I was in there, there was kids riding bikes through the middle of it, and the staff were going, get off the bikes. And it was just, it seemed huger and a lot more fun.
It's big, weird, wonderful. I don't shop there usually, but when I'm there, I'll pick up something that I happen to need if I'm just there filming Ashley. But yeah, there's that website, The People of Walmart. Don't know if you've seen that.
Yes. Yeah. It's not very complimentary.
And when you go, it is kind of like that. It's very weird place, Walmart.
Yeah. It probably depends on the store. I'm not sponsored by Walmart at all, so you can say what you want. But Ashley's diametrically opposite to the website, People of Walmart. She's always got a chipper smile and super helpful. But yeah, even in the last video, I'm filming the bit and I've edited it, probably watched that bit, you know, 100 times during the editing. Something I didn't even notice in the comments, people were like, oh yeah, 1:11, man pushes shopping trolley while identically dressed man climbs into trolley and man looks at camera. I didn't even notice this is going on in the background.
it's very strange. When we were there, some guy was like, can you get British bullets and sell them in a car park? We're like, what? And he was a member of staff. Very strange.
That's so weird. It's another world.
The wonderful world of Walmart.
Yeah.
You mentioned your Commodore Plus 4 video there as well. I really enjoyed watching that because that was actually my first computer as a kid. So it was nice to see someone covering that video. I think you're very fair to the system as well, because I know a lot of people just kind of make videos to hate on it and, you know, go on about how awful the machine was. But, you talked about its limitations, but also I think it looked like you enjoyed discovering some stuff on it too.
Definitely, yeah. Now you mentioned it, I remember your video about that, and I'd forgotten about that. But I had never used it, and I had no idea what it was, what it was all about, and, you know, why was it called Plus 4, and why did it fail? It discontinued after a year. But definitely there were downsides. You know, the business productivity software was not very productive. But when I started to play the games and things, modern things as well, like Pets Rescue, but we play through Mercenary on the video, find some of the Easter eggs in that. And the 12939 supply, you remember that? The turned out to be Pepsi, if you looked at it backwards. Yeah. All those fun little things. It's got a lot going for it, and I kind of started to feel sorry for it having this reputation. Mm. It looks amazing. It's definitely one of the sexiest retro computers, up there with the Amiga 500 for me in looks. It's got a great keyboard and so much you can do with it, even without hardware sprites. It's still in the software. The stuff they've done with it in Pets Rescue is amazing. So I started with the business software filming it, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. This is going to make a really boring video. And I actually sat on that footage for a few months, just did nothing with it. And then I came back to it and started to play the games, and I really fell in love with it. So I'm keeping the one that I've got now, and that's got pride of place above the Commodore 64 in the studio there. So I can see why you love it. It's a really interesting little machine.
I mean, do you find it interesting to discover new platforms and maybe systems that are a bit obscure?
I do. So I sort of have to force myself to do that, because that's not born out of nostalgia. And I always try to cover stuff that I genuinely am excited about. But occasionally, you know, like with this new cartridge and graphic user interface, or systems like it was a console, a Sega console that I'd never really used, but I wanted to just explore a bit about it. And then you start to discover stuff and you find the old commercials on YouTube, and it's easy to actually get into the nostalgia of something that isn't your own nostalgia. And that's the nice thing about it as well. There's so many consoles out there. I've got a list of videos that stretches until the middle of 2020. But if I ever run out, I've always got new ones to explore. So that's a really nice thing.
Everybody has a video that kind of blew up and brought their channel to life, really. Which one was it for you?
For me, there was two videos that really blew up the subscriber numbers. First one, I covered an extreme refurb of an Atari 800 XL. It was done by a friend of mine in Poland called Pete, a.k.a. Drygol. And you'd never seen a console in such bad condition. We think it had been stored under a pile of junk in a basement or something. The case was cracked to pieces. The keyboard was bowed and all the keys were scratched. And he actually created resin molds from a, you know, a real, not a real, they're both real, but from a good quality 800 XL and was able to mold the missing fragments of the case and repair the motherboard. And it just an incredible thing. And we still get comments saying this is the most extreme refurb and the, you know, the best saving of a computer that I've ever seen. But then on the other hand, some people don't get it. They say, well, you had a working one there that you took the molds from. Why didn't you just use that and throw the other one away? But for us, it's not, and I'm sure you agree, it's not about that. Because one day there's going to be, what, 1,000 of these left. Another day there'll be only 100. And one day there'll only be like one working one of these left. So I think everyone that we can save and put back together is important. And yeah, the other video was the Lego Commodore 64. For obvious reasons, I'd seen this mini Lego Commodore 64 and 3 inches long. I thought, wouldn't it be incredible to get a working one with spring-loaded keyboard and that you could actually put a real Commodore motherboard inside? And we even ended up hooking it up to the motherboard to the Lego LED. So when you turn on the computer, the LED comes on the top. And one of the weirdest discoveries, I still don't understand this, is the Commodore 64 keycaps, they share the same axle hole inside as Lego axle pieces. So if you get a 2x2 Lego brick with an axle in it, you can stick them onto the real Commodore 64 keyboard and use Lego keys. So I've got a really special episode coming up next weekend where I'm going to be building the world's first completely new Commodore 64. Because, of course, you can buy Commodore motherboards like the Ultimate 64 or the Reloaded. You can buy cases from Pixel Wizard, and you can even buy a keyboard base, something called the MechBoard 64. But nobody's got a solution for the keycaps. So I'm going to make these available to order, and I'm custom printing the top of the Lego tiles with all the Petsky and the original Commodore 64C font. So it kind of looks like a real keyboard, and it's going to be functional too.
Well, you've done a lot of kind of restoration and refurbishing of machines. What do you need to check when you're restoring a machine and look out for?
I mean, there are the obvious things. You know, it's always good to replace the capacitors. People say it's not an issue, but I have seen them where they've, you know, blown up and that's then going to blow out other chips and the SID chips particularly susceptible. So replace the capacitors. I think the biggest rule is if it isn't broke, don't try and fix it apart from that. In my early days, you know, I'd be refurbing something and end up breaking something in the process. You've probably done it as well. Mm. So, you know, if it's working, just give it a bit of a clean up so it looks visually good. Replace the capacitors and otherwise leave it alone. But then when you start to get into Commodore 64 problems, that's where it becomes a minefield. And coming up soon, I'm going to be doing an interactive Commodore 64 repair. So you've seen Bandersnatch, right?
Yeah. Amazing.
So it's going to, yeah, amazing. It's going to be like that. So I'm going to present the problem. And then at the end of each clip, you'll have two options that you can choose. So it could be replace the CIAs, or it could be check the traces on the board. And it'll go through, I think there's something like 200 combinations. And you can work with me on finding what the problem is to repair this board. We've got some special guests coming in to give some help as well, like the 8-bit guy. So you can click on Ask the 8-Bit Guy.
That'll
pop up with his suggestion, stuff like that. Yeah, that should help out anyone wanting to refurb and reincarnate one of those old boards.
I think it'll help Ravi as well. He's got a Commodore 64 that it was black screening. He couldn't get anything out of it. Sent it away to get repaired and it worked fine for the guy you sent it to, didn't it?
That always happens.
Oh, no. That's weird.
Yeah, I think maybe, do you think it was in the post? Maybe some of the chips maybe got like resocketed or something.
Yeah, God knows, because I've done that twice with him now. Yeah. So if this isn't working, it works fine.
Does it work when he sends it back to you then?
Yeah, yeah.
Weird.
Oh, yeah.
As long as it doesn't charge you for it.
I'd say you're right, Dan. It probably something got reseated, or I've even found like solder fragments in between pins of the ICs. And then if that gets knocked out of place, then it'll just start working could be something like that.
Well, we left it in the boot of Dan's car at an airport in the middle of winter for about 2 weeks.
So, probably didn't help in hindsight, I guess.
Didn't help, no. Shame on you.
Well, have you got any techniques for retrobrighting that you use?
Yeah, I've had mixed results, really, with retrobrighting, like a lot of people. One thing I'm doing soon, so I was talking to David Murray, a.k.a. the 9-bit guy, the 8-bit guy, the extra bits for parity, by the way. And I think one of the interesting things is using ozone generators, because for me it's such a pain in the backside getting all the cream everywhere and cling film or saran wrap, as we call it, saran wrap. So what I'm going to be doing is putting a machine in a computer in a large enclosure and trying to find a way to pump in ozone and keep it circulating. So we're going to need an inlet and an outlet. Stick it out in the sunshine as well, because you need the heat or the UV, and see if we can just find a way to retrobrite, you know, hands off, just with a certain gas. So you don't have to worry about all that cream and nonsense and streakiness. So that's going to be really interesting to see how that turns out.
Because I had a retrobrighting disaster last year. I tried to do an Amiga 3000 keyboard, and it got the marbling effect on it, unfortunately, off the cling film.
No. We've all had our retrobrite mares.
So what are some of the kind of best mods and upgrades that you've done? Like, what do you rate the most?
That's another really good question. I think the Music Maker is my favorite, because it's something I still use. It wasn't just done for a video, just to put something out there. I really loved the Atari 400 video mod, because that one had this terrible RF output, such a noisy picture, low volume. So there's a really cool S-Video and composite mod that you can wire in. It's just a tiny little PCB, about an inch squared. And the result of that, I did retrobrite that one as well, which went badly. So I ended up respraying it with some color matching help from Walmart employees. But the result when I turned that on with the S-Video composite mod in there just blew me away. Like, it's this crystal clear, crisp image. For me, that's what really resonates, and kind of, my mum would always say, find something to do in life that makes your heart sing. Like, it's really smolchy and gooey sounding, but when I get an old machine that's been passed, you know, along through various people and definitely seen better days, and then you upgrade it with this tiny little change, but it brings about a completely new machine that you fall in love with, because it looks like brand new. You know, the picture is crystal clear, and the paint job is like it came out of the factory. And for me, that's what it's all about, is those little mods that make such a big difference.
I love some of the kind of more, you know, off the wall kind of stuff you've done as well, like the Apple II Pi. that video was really cool. And the Commodore 64 Mini inside a full-size 64.
Yeah, I like to go wacky sometimes as well. I'm always surprised nobody's done it, because the C64 Mini was just begging to be stuck inside of a mother C64, like a little baby. Yeah, we found the Kira version 2, which allows you to take the real Commodore 64 keyboard and convert it into a USB output. So I installed that inside the case, and the USB output goes into the Mini, which allows you to use the full-size keyboard to type basic programs in the Mini. We ended up giving that away to a contest winner, which I'm kind of sad about, because I wanted to keep it. The Apple Pi was a lot of fun. So on Craigslist locally, I got a, you know, a retro haul, as you do. And one of the things was this empty Apple IIe case with a keyboard. And I thought, wouldn't it be great just to bring this back to life and restore it into the machine it used to be? But I did it with a Raspberry Pi, and I got the oldest Pi that I could find as well. I think it was a Model B, to get as retro even on that as I could. And found a USB interface for that, so you can use the Apple IIe keyboard and the old joysticks as well, all connected to the Pi. And then I passed it around to Jan Bieter in Germany and Mindflare Retro in Canada, and it ended up with the 8-bit guy who improved all the things that we'd done that he didn't like, and added some other stuff too. So it's now this fully-fledged machine that I did a contest, and then the winner came up, and I chose the contest at random using we used atmospheric noise, so basically the sound of lightning, to generate a random winner. And the winner it chose was in Mongolia. So then I had to ship this beast of a machine Luckily, it turns out he was actually studying in Turkey, so it was a little less expensive to get out there. But yeah, that's now living a happy new life after just being in a pile of junk in Los Angeles. So it's always fun to do that kind of stuff. A little wacky, but it brings them back to life.
Well, you mentioned mini systems there, and there's tons around at the moment. Are there any systems that you think should be miniaturized?
Wow.
Ravi wants a CDI mini, don't you?
Does he? I mean, I don't have a preference, honestly. You could do it with any of them. I don't know how much I love the idea. That said, I've got the SNES Mini and the C64 Mini, so I guess I like it.
There's something about them that just makes you want to buy them, though, even though you've got the original. Yeah. It's weird.
I think the N64 would be fabulous because of it's always hard to get the output on the N64.
And the emulation's a bit janky still, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's still hard, even on RetroArch, to emulate that. I guess it's because they're small, isn't it? They're cute. We love puppies and babies and stuff. that you can't resist them. But there is something amazing when you walk into a shop like Walmart and you see a C64 of any kind on the shelf again for the first time since you were 13 or whatever. So that is pretty cool. And I can't help going on live onto the Patreon lens and just doing a little live video. And I walk into GameStop and they've got a new batch of C64 minis just sitting there. There's something about it. But I guess an A500 would be cool as well, maybe.
Yeah, my mum was in a shop, actually. I think she was in Game or something, and she spotted, like, the 64, and she sent me a picture, like, they're selling these again. She was, like, amazed.
My mum wouldn't know what it was, I don't think.
I love the way my mum thought I hadn't heard about it, though, and she was, like, the first to break the news to me. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, mum, I've had 100 emails about that. Thank you.
talking about the 64 as well, you recently covered a new Commodore 64 desktop GUI as well.
Yeah, so I referenced that earlier. That's the Mini Gangcart, and it's this... Initially, it kind of seemed like a hodgepodge of various things stuck together. So it's got an SD2IEC on this cartridge. It's got a machine code disassembler. Kind of cool thing that as soon as you turn the machine on, it presents you with a list of function keys so you know exactly what you're doing, which would be great for Ashley React because she'd actually see, if I hit F5, it's going to load a directory. And it has like this telepathic F5 key. So you can load up a directory just straight in BASIC and scroll up and just hit F5 and it'll open that folder. And then you can hit F5, it'll open the next folder. Hit F5 again, it'll open whatever, it'll run, load and run whatever game or program the cursor is over. So that's really nice. But then on the other side of it, it's got this GUI, as you said. So I think a couple of years ago, there was a Cena's release and major update to the final cartridge 3. And they updated it with a whole load of new tools. And it's a mouse-driven GUI. So I've got out the 1531 mouse on the Commodore 64. And in the video, I go through all the menu options. You know, it's got a notepad and calculator. And you can even put drop-down menus on top of BASIC. And that was, to me, that blew me away. So you can be writing a program and just move the mouse and the menus appear. And you can renumber the program automatically through one of the options. So if you run out of line numbers, for example, and you can just, you know, click file save and it'll save your BASIC program to your project folder. Isn't that incredible? Like with 38 bytes free, you can get a GUI system going over that.
Because I even thought GEOS was impressive back in the day, but you know, that just took it to a whole new level.
Yeah, I mean, GEOS is fantastic. And I never knew about GEOS. Did you guys know about it?
Yeah, I remember seeing it quite. It was probably about the early 90s when I saw it. I remember seeing it. I think they were selling the Commodore 64C in like Tandy or somewhere, and they were bundling it with it, probably about 1990-91.
I never knew about it, and I wondered if I would have kept the Commodore 64 a bit longer instead of moving to the Amiga. And funny to think they probably were selling it in Walmart back then as well. Yeah. They probably did actually know about it. It's funny, I loaded up an old disc that I found in the attic. It was my Amstrad PCW letters disc. And it had all my Zap 64 letters. And I covered one of those in that GUI video. The Commodore 64, I found this letter I'd written back in 82, I guess, to a friend saying, I was going to get the Commodore 128. Or maybe an Amiga, but I found this Evesham Micros do this case that makes your Commodore 64 look like a C64C. So I don't need an Amiga. I'm just going to get that new case. Same thing, right?
It's always cringe to read stuff you wrote as a kid, isn't it?
I know. So cringe. So cringe, yeah.
Well, talking about the Amiga, I absolutely loved your video about getting the 500 to have modern email. Do you get a kick of kind of getting these retro machines online and getting them to still communicate?
Don't you mean do I get a kickstart out of it?
There you go.
My channel is known for its terrible humour. Thank you very much. I really do, and it ties back into that thing with the Atari, you know, getting it to go to a whole new level. I like to kind of try and do world firsts, like with the, you know, the Commodore 64 keycaps or whatever it is, just to reinvigorate discussion in the community and those machines. Nobody had managed to get modern email. And by modern email, I mean like through Ethernet, for example. So dial-up, obviously, you could have had back then on the A500 and probably did. But getting high speed, and by high speed, I mean it was pushing about 1200 kbps through the parallel port, getting that working. So I found this thing called the Plip Box, and it's like an Arduino kind of device, but it does fit into the parallel port of the Amiga. So with a very specific firmware flash to it, and a specially written driver, you can use it to hook up to your modern day Ethernet or your cable internet. And then the issue really then became encryption, because the Amiga 500 just can't handle encryption. But luckily I found my local ISP. They don't encrypt the outgoing stuff if you send it with your username and password. So the SMTP output, which is where the encryption issue happens, wasn't a factor there either. So through some, you know, huge coincidence of various factors working in my favor, I was able to start sending and receiving email on the Amiga 500. And I think to this day, nobody said that they were able to get that going. So that was kind of nice. And I still have the email address open, so I still get emails to the Amiga. People just say, hello, is anyone there? And I'll send a reply, and in the signature it says...
Was that like POP3 or IMAP, was it?
Yes, it is POP3, and I'm using YAM. I think it's version 3.2. YAM is yet another mailer. And then I always send the signature, says, sent from my Commodore Amiga 500.
Just like iPhones and that do today,
yeah.
Android.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, speaking of cool machines, I mean, you did mention before that you backed the Spectrum Next. I mean, what are you looking forward to about that machine?
Yeah, it looks so good. For me, what sold it, I'm very visual, so what sold it was the styling. And obviously it was designed by one of the original designers of the Spectrum, who sadly passed away recently. But it just looks amazing. What a legacy that he's leaving behind. But also updated versions of favorite games. So I used to go around to my friend's house. I never had a Spectrum, but my friend Matthew had a Spectrum, and then the Spectrum Plus 2 and micro drives. And we would play Attic Attack nonstop. So there's now an updated version of Attic Attack that takes advantage of the new features of the Next, you know, the added colors and graphics and sound. So playing that with the old school feel, but updated for 2019. I mean, how amazing is that?
And it is just a beautiful looking machine, isn't it?
Yeah, those color pops on the right-hand side, for me, I don't know, there's just something about it, isn't there? Because it always had those color stripes on the side of the Spectrum. There's even the keys, I mean, that two-tone, it's got the piano black polish on one part of the keycap, and then the matte bit for where you want to grip. Yeah, just lovely. I'm really excited. I'll be doing probably a live unboxing, I think, maybe with that.
Well, what are your kind of future hopes and plans for your channel?
I've got that long list of fun stuff, and the challenge really is deciding what to do next, because I'm always juggling five projects, and I've filmed little bits of each of them, and it's like, what do you put out next? So really, I just want to continue to have people come join me, subscribe and all that good stuff, but more than that, to just keep invigorating that discussion. And if you can do things like LGR did, for example, was getting a floppy disk drive working with his cell phone, you know, stuff like that. I love that modern twist on the retro. That's really useful for the community, because I've heard people even saying, you know, they were in a store or something, I think it was, and someone's dad said, oh yeah, that guy built a Lego 64 out of like a working Lego 64. And to think that it's kind of transcending generations and even getting those people talking about it is really lovely. So yeah, just continue to do that kind of stuff and get people talking and get these machines the love they deserve.
Well, Christian, we love your channel, and you know, it's great to see all the different things that you're coming up with and this love that you've got for these classic systems. If people want to find your channel, we'll of course put a link in our show notes. Do you have a website and Twitter and all that as well?
Yeah, all that good stuff. If you just go to perifractic.com, there's links there for everything you need.
Wonderful, and keep up the good work with the channel. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you guys so much. Lovely chatting with you.